Podcasting is a complicated profession, and that's why we're here to discuss a movie from 1958.
Okay.
Entitled Hidden Fortress. My name is Dan Moore, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host. Kat Benish is here. Hi, Kat.
I was confused by the definition of hidden fortress in this movie because it wasn't really a fortress, but I'm wondering if there's something in the translation that perhaps I missed.
Also, more than 50% of this movie does not involve the hidden fortress at all.
Yeah. But I mean, but titles of movies rarely relate to like what's actually going on.
Oh, yeah. Like Superman. Tony Sindelar is also here.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hello, nerds. Thanks for having me back. I am reading that the original Japanese title, Kat, this is not going to improve the situation for you.
Yep.
But how do you feel? If anything, this provokes more questions.
I think we have to answer some questions based on
the
this.
The Japanese title is The Three Villains of the Hidden Fortress.
The three villains?
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, you're immediately going to ask who the three villains are then. And I'm like, I don't have that
answer. Who are the three villains of the Hidden Fortress?
Thank you. You're like four lines of code. I don't know.
Well, there's that one general.
Okay.
Right? That he, like,
I don't.
We're just diving in.
This is a strange way to start a podcast.
Yeah. Yes. Anyways. Okay. Well, I think we have to assume that our average listener has not watched.
Who are the three villains of the Hidden Fortress? Stay tuned to find out.
You say you're a fan of Hidden Fortress villains. Name three.
We should probably briefly go over the plot.
So, well, let's briefly explain why we're discussing Hidden Fortress.
Start with why.
We had a Wheel of Fortune and we rotated it.
Yeah.
I believe that is not how the Wheel of Fortune works. It's got money numbers on it.
Are you thinking about the wheel from Price is Right?
Yeah, you did also mime it like it was a vertical wheel and it's a horizontal wheel. Also, that wheel also just has money on it.
But you got the point, right? It was a wheel. Then we like spun the wheel and picked something.
I was really distracted by how you both did the wrong kind of wheel motion and named a wheel that was confusing to me. So there was probably a solid point in there.
It's just like bingo. And we're pulling it and grabbing a number. And that number corresponds to a roadmap. And that roadmap tells us where to go. I was actually recently into a store and they were selling roadmap like atlases. And I was like, ooh, atlas. That's very exciting.
Vintage.
Yeah.
I don't remember enough about Plinko to tell if that was a valid metaphor. Dan, why did we watch this?
Well, so Plinko versus Pachinko. Anyways.
A Hidden Fortress, a movie by Akira Kurosawa, among many samurai movies that he made in his life.
And other movies, too. He didn't just...
He did do movies other than samurai movies, it's true. But he became sort of emblematic for his take on the samurai movie, which was kind of a very Western-influenced take. But it went on to influence a lot of filmmakers, notably George Lucas, who talked a lot about how the sort of structure of this movie influenced some of the choices he made in filming Star Wars. I think I probably going in, I don't think I had seen this before. If I had, it'd been a very long time ago. But I think in my head, there were many more like lines drawn between this and Star Wars, which in retrospect, there's actually only a few. It's pretty sparse.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements.
So to go over the plot briefly,
it's a very quick plot.
I mean, one would like to think so, but essentially,
it's a 2.5 hour movie.
It's a surprisingly long movie.
But the plot itself is fairly simple.
Yes, the plot itself is fairly simple, which is there are these two peasants who have basically been stuck in this battle.
We're going to call them Tahei and
Matsuchi. I can't pronounce. I'm sorry for the...
I do not know how to say the names either.
And Tahei.
Okay.
Tahei and Matsuchi. Okay.
And they're kind of comedic characters.
Yes, they're down on their luck.
They came
to the war. They showed up late. They got pressed into service as grave diggers. They're wandering
because they thought we're for the wrong side. Like, the guys who just like always get bad luck.
They're losers.
Like bad luck. Yeah.
So they are basically down on their luck and wandering around out of this war that has just taken place and trying to get back across the border to get home. This adventure,
They're currently. And I think this is important, right? So they are currently in the
Yamana.
No, they're in the
The Akuchi.
Akazuki province. They're trying to go back to the Hayakawa province. And then parallel to them both is the Yamana province.
Who just basically won the war.
Won the war, yes.
So the war is kind of over, but there's lots of mop-up happening. There's lots of soldiers running around everywhere. There's some missions and stuff. But it's kind of like, it's like, I don't know if this counts as a war movie. It feels like a war movie, but it's like the battle, you just missed the battle, right? Like everything ended. But things are you're not free to move around your country yet.
But
there's checkpoints everywhere.
And, yeah.
Because the princess survived and the gold. So they can't claim Yamana cannot claim complete victory until they find the princess.
Yeah, so the princess
and
is
the
missing. And there's also, we know, 200 sort of pieces of gold that are missing.
And I guess the gold was kind of a parallel to the Death Star plans.
I guess.
I can kind of see
it. Sure. So these guys are down on their luck. They're just trying to get home. At one point, they discover a piece of gold basically embedded in a stick.
How it got there? Not entirely sure.
The suggestion is that they, like, basically the Akazuki clan hid them in all these sticks. Mm-hmm. Anyway. They find it. They decide there must be more. They start looking for it, and they basically encounter a stranger who basically presses them into service / threatens them. He at some point claims to be an Akazuki general.
The peasants don't believe him and start laughing.
Yeah.
Us listeners or watchers are like, he probably is actually that general.
Named Rokurota. And he basically leads them back to the titular hidden fortress, which is a bunch of buildings in a mountain cave.
I will say, what do you visualize when you hear the word hidden fortress?
I envision in Tokyo, I forget the name, but there's the Imperial Castle in downtown.
So you envisioned a castle.
I envisioned a castle. Like,
but
literally
hidden.
The castle that was in downtown Tokyo. I forget the name.
I maybe envisioned something like in a cave. This is three cabins in a mountain.
It's a summer home.
I expect Heidi to show up next door.
It is, it's real light on the fortress. It's very hidden.
Yeah, hidden.
But the fortress elements
hidden.
Of it.
Got.
There's other stuff in it, so it seemed like that was a choice as opposed to a budget thing. There's other very elaborate set pieces.
Well, it's hard to build a big fortress in a mountain. Just talk to the dwarves.
Well, and the bigger you make it, the less hidden it is.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I had no issues with it. I guess the probably interpretation of the word fortress, it could have been I don't know, retreat. and it was very hidden. There was a cave structure, so it was probably very defensible. I think once they got into the caves, I felt a lot more believable that this is defensible, and those are just some of the outhouses and stuff. But the
So they're basically pressed into service. Going to the fortress, they also see there's a young woman there. Most of us probably put together that is the princess. These guys, not so smart. And essentially, they end up collecting a whole bunch of the wood and trying to travel back to Hayakawa with it. In a very variety of disguises and pretenses. And most of the movie is them basically trying to get the gold out.
But constantly being conflicted by greed, right? And I think the general says at one point, the one thing we count on these two peasants is their greed. And so they're constantly fighting each other for the gold. They're constantly trying to run away. And they keep failing at that.
Because they keep coming back looking for more gold.
Yeah.
It's as if it was a group of people rolling a barrel of gold across a desert.
Reference acknowledged, Dan.
Was that a TPK
reference?
That is a reference that is only useful to people who played in a Dungeons & Dragons Dark Sun adventure I ran 17-ish years ago.
That wasn't televised.
That was not recorded or televised, and most of the people on that adventure are on this podcast.
I could not stop thinking about it during the course of this.
I did feel like...
I
thought that was a genius thing, was give the players immeasurable wealth and put them in a place where they had no ability to spend it, and they would basically destroy themselves. I thought I had created that as a novel idea. No,
you're basically Akira Kurosawa, Tony. Congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd seen that particular story somewhere else, but yeah, it turns out, you know, you give people heavy, valuable things and make them roll it, travel with it. It's a real pain.
Yeah, really, you know? Yeah, it is. Yeah. And they learn this firsthand here. So
They fight about it constantly, and they make poor choices. So
many bad choices.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we learn a lot about, I mean, I don't know if what was interesting, because it's, if generally plot and then like, princess, it's happy story, everyone wins. And at the very, very end, the peasants actually finally agree to, they get one piece of gold to share, and they learn, at the very end, it's showing that they potentially have changed and are learning to share it.
I will say, and this is a very long movie, I was real nervous, like, as I was like, I have been watching this movie for 2 hours, I cannot tell how it's going to end.
Yeah.
And I don't know enough about like the format of like a samurai movie or a samurai war epic. Like, are they all going to die? Are those peasants going to be murdered? Like, you know, the fact that it basically has a happy ending for everybody was not, I felt like that was not guaranteed by the plot or the tone.
I was looking up a little bit of Kurosawa a bit, and I am definitely not a Kurosawa expert. This is the first Kurosawa movie I've actually ever seen. And two thoughts on this. One is, I think I did read a little bit about Kurosawa and who's the lead actor again, dear?
Toshiro Mifune.
Mifune. And who starred in a lot of Kurosawa's movies.
Yeah.
And apparently Kurosawa has a very positive view of humans and people in general. And I'd read that like a lot of his movies, this may or may not be true, actually are not dark endings.
I'm thinking in particular, like, you know, his large influences are, you know, in some ways it's fascinating because the movies he makes influence Westerns, but he was also influenced by earlier Westerns.
Yeah.
Literal, like John Ford apparently was somebody that he had a lot of inspiration from, who made like Stagecoach. And so you can kind of see from that, like, in some ways, you know, Tony, you mentioned war epics, but I think it's honestly much more of a Western movie than a war movie, because the war itself is never seen, but we feel the impact of it. And I think that's true a lot in Western movies, a lot of which are influenced by the Civil War, but generally it's on the periphery.
I think this reminds me a lot of like True Grit. I haven't seen The Searchers in years.
I really don't like that movie.
I don't remember it. But the other thing I was going to say is, I don't know, Tony, did you watch the recent Shogun?
Yes.
Okay. So one thing I remember that was very rememberable from that movie is just the way people walked, especially the women. You remember that, like, that little tiptoe. And if someone knows this better than I do, feel free to correct me. Like, I'm not the expert. I just remember looking at this up being like, oh, is that just a style? And there was something about that was a certain style of like movement. Oh, God, I'm gonna get this wrong. That either came from an earlier version of theater, but this thing is like, that's actually not historically accurate, but it became the way that people represented it that was accurate. And I thought
kind of like how every representation of like Egypt in films does
exactly
not look, there would be Egyptian royalty would be actually look Greek, but that wouldn't, you know. We've decided that doesn't work for film or whatever reason, and so now we're stuck not doing that. And
yeah, exactly. And I find it very interesting, especially in sort of like non-American cultures, like just seeing what is their way of representing the past, because it's still very like it's. Yes. I remember seeing like if you see movies of this time, like what did the Revolutionary War look like? You're like, oh, that still kind of looks really like the 1950s. And that was really interesting, in just seeing the representation of the people outside of it and trying to figure out like when did sort of those little the ways to show you were in different time periods, was that now or then? Like, makes me want to go read a lot more about that.
I was kind of surprised by the comedic tone of the movie.
Yeah.
I guess I've seen a couple Kurosawa movies, so it's been a long time since I've seen them. I feel like I think I watched a couple in college, and it's been a while since that. And I don't think of them as being kind of silly. And this is a movie that has a lot of humor in it, especially the two peasant characters. Very slapsticky. I was kind of thinking about, there's a decent number of scenes that like you could almost watch without captions or without subtitles and know what's going on, because they do so much kind of acting with their body and their, you know,
they're
like
very
it's
malleable faces. Yeah. Like they're doing really
very
exaggerated
big
expressions.
Actions. Yeah. And you know, and a lot, like, I don't know. I was, you know, those two characters are the big Star Wars inspiration, in that basically those two characters kind of map to R2-D2 and C-3PO in terms of like we're going to start with these people who are nobodies, who are caught up in galactic conflict, and follow them. And I was even, you know, I think the parallels start to get a little bit more, you know, tenuous after that. But, you know, the movie starts with them just like walking across a field.
Yeah.
And I was reminded of like in A New Hope when they're walking around Tatooine, yeah, and then they get in an argument and they split up. And that literally happens in this movie. Or when they were walking to Jabba's palace and they're bickering with each other. It is very that, right?
Yeah. For me, it was a lot there's a lot of the climbing up these scree filled rock faces. And it made me just think of the shots of 3PO walking up. Like the sand dunes, that it just seems so Sisyphusian.
I think we watched the Criterion Collection does have, if you watch this on there, there's a 8-minute interview with George Lucas, which is I guess from one of the DVD releases, talking about his inspiration from it. And I think two things became clear from that. One, you know, obviously, as you said, the two peasant characters representing R2 and 3PO, not just in the nature of their relationship, but as he points out, he liked the idea of this big epic story being narrated by the kind of lowest of classes, and he sort of transplanted that idea, which, like, as we also know, like, kind of from the prequels and a little bit of the sequels as well, but the kind of how he envisioned it was that those characters, the droids, would be kind of omnipresent throughout the entire story.
And I don't love the droid slapstick stuff that we get in Star Wars, and there's a lot of it in the prequels, right? I don't love that, but like I see what he was inspired by, right?
Right.
I see what he's going for, and you know, maybe that's not for me, but you can see
but
what he was seeking to do.
The other part of it, if I can just finish that thought, the second thing was that it reminded me how much Lucas is a filmmaker's filmmaker. He is very technically proficient. He loves, like, he is knowledgeable about film history and about technique and about all that stuff. He was you really get sort of his film student background there. Mm-hmm. And he talks a lot about the imagery and the way Kurosawa shoots things. And you can, I think, see a lot of influence from that in various places throughout, throughout all the Star Wars movies he made. Because I think, you know, one of the things I was reminded by was, like, you know, despite my problems with things like The Phantom Menace, like, the imagery and framing of shots and the look of the movie is really well done, because he knows what he's doing when it comes to how to sort of, like, shoot something. And so shots that are inspired. Like, I was thinking the very first shot, if you remember from the trailer for Phantom Menace, is like the Gungans coming through like the fog.
Yeah.
And that's a very Kurosawa shot right there.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, you can tell. I mean, that's, I mean, I, you know, we're hard on George Lucas, as is reality at this stage of his life, but he's done a lot of good things, and he is very proficient at some things. I think his, you know, he clearly thinks about these movies visually in a way that is very powerful, that not all directors out there do. And, you know, I think his weaknesses are probably dialogue and maybe his ability to direct human actors. but he definitely has a vision for what he wants his story to look like, I think that's where he's extremely successful. And you know, I think that's a huge part of what makes Star Wars successful, is that, you know, we've seen these images, whether we saw them as kids or as adults, and like there are these things that you immediately, like, your brain grasps to, think, like, hooks into you and does not let go, that speak to that.
Well, building on that, that was exactly where I wanted to go. And just talking about, right after we finished this, Dan and I actually started the ILM mini.
Oh, nice.
Season two. I haven't seen season one, but just season two. And first off, incredible. Second, I'm really glad they give I'm a Best just so much space to talk, at least in the first two episodes we've seen. That was just really beautiful and touching and heart wrenching. But I think two things from that. One is, again, tying it back to Hidden Fortress, is the humor and the slapstick and just like dare to be dopey, right? That I think, to your point, that I think he was really influenced by these. And also,
Buster Keaton,
yeah, right? And then I think that physicality of both of these, both the Kurosawa and the acting we saw, and Buster Keaton. And then I don't think I appreciated growing up, especially just how much the original, excuse me, the prequels pushed the technology in filmmaking. Like, I think I didn't really understood what it means that the second movie was the first time they ever shot with digital cameras.
Yeah.
And both that, and then, yeah, the cinematography and the shots, and definitely the original three, the new three, the, sorry, there's just so many now. The prequels, as we call them, are absolutely beautiful. And again, I a lot of the shots I thought were similar in Hidden Fortress, and just some really beautiful shots working. I also love black and white movies. It's always fun to go back and watch. There's just some nice fun. It's beautiful. They're always beautiful.
I was really impressed. You know, this is a movie made in the 50s. And like, you can just, and with, you know, pretty limited technology at that time compared to what we have now. And, you know, there are these scenes with like just huge crowds of people, mm-hmm. whether in a city or when there's like, you know, there's
the
uprising
in the prisoner uprising.
No way out.
There's stuff later where they're like, people are running through the forest and stuff, or they're getting shot at. And, you know, the special effects there are a little janky, but it's 1958.
Yeah.
You know, and there's stuff, you know, I love the images where like the soldiers are closing in on the people that are being hunted, and we are our heroes. And it's like, we see the banners behind the soldiers, like behind, you know, behind a ledge or rise on a hill or something like that. And it just, it works so well.
It does.
I mean, it's great.
Well, there's, you know, in the 8-minute video on the Criterion, when they're doing George Lucas, they actually talk about some of Kurosawa's advancements. And there was one, I don't know if you remember this one, Tony, but when at the very beginning, when the peasants are sort of talking through, and then you know someone is coming, and you just see the one soldier appear who looks horrified and is killed in front of you, but you don't see through by who. And it's just really, really stunning stuff. But yeah, it's also interesting to me that, so 1958, I'm always very intrigued and fascinated by movies that were made, like, this was 12 years after the end of World War II.
Yeah,
13 as a country is rebuilding and dealing with all of that. And just always interesting to see how much and whether or not sort of that zeitgeist flows over into the movie.
Right. And Lucas talks a little bit about how Kurosawa is actually, you know, some of they look down on him a little bit because he is so heavily Western influenced. What he's doing is very Western, as opposed to, you know, he's sort of melding. He's like fusing kind of Western, you know, Westerns literally with the samurai story. And it's not until later that he starts to get some more appreciation for that within Japan. But it is interesting too, because it is, you know, there's a whole cultural shift there of, you know, these are the people, importing the culture of the people who defeated you, right? Like, that has a lot of implications into it. But as you say, like, you know, a decade later, it's interesting how it evolves. But I think, I don't think this is the strongest Kurosawa movie, certainly of the ones I've seen. It is a little, it's interesting in that it has a very limited cast of characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have our group of four and
basically
occasional other people.
And the three villains. Let's not forget the three villains, Tony.
we're like 30 minutes into the podcast. Kat, who do you think the three villains are in The Hidden Fortress?
And it's three villains? That's not a mistranslation?
The three villains.
Not like the three villagers?
It's like man versus society, versus the environment.
Yeah,
greed
is your first villain.
A villain?
Avarice is your second one, which is just Dunkirk is your
the
third
movie
villain.
Of the year.
Movie of the year.
I guess my only option that makes sense is that the general and the two peasants must be the villain because the princess is the hero. That doesn't make any sense, though.
Well, the villains could be from the sense of like a Shakespearean, like, thou art a villain sort of thing, where it's like, wasn't like the original like connotation of that just like lower class? Like,
you might be right. Maybe it's the three. Well, that sounds good.
Thanks. You know, what makes them villains, right? Maybe it's because they're on the wrong side of the law, as it were. You know.
Yeah, if it were four, they'd be the four villains escaping. Yeah. But we also know
the princess can't be a villain. That doesn't make any sense.
And then we know they left some people behind.
How do you feel about the fact that the princess doesn't get any dialogue for a large chunk of the
movie? So let's actually talk about the sexism here for a second. So I'm okay with this. Here's my opinion on this. I have two opinions. Mm-hmm. One, I was annoyed by that at first, and that they were going to try reverse psychology on her. So basically, the general at one point when talking to essentially her advisor, saying like, she's very stubborn. If I say right, she goes left. If I say left, she goes right. Therefore, I'm going to convince her that she can't do this. And he tries that. I do really appreciate the Princess Shabon saying, like, I know exactly what you're doing, but I think that is actually the best solution. I'm going to do it anyways. And I thought that was actually really nice of, like, both allowing some humor, but also giving her a lot of agency and, like, choosing the way she was. So I was fine with her. And she still spoke sometime now and again.
Yeah.
And she still was a very dynamic force.
Yes.
I definitely had some issues with there's some weird sexual overtones that get very skeezy.
And it's sexual like assault.
But 1958. And I was like, but at the same time, I spent easily half the movie ogling Mifune's like thighs because they were amazing, like amazing thighs. And I looked up later, like, I think he was a huge sex symbol for like through all of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, this is fine. I can live with this.
There's also, I mean, there is a couple things happening here, which is one, there is a reality aspect to it of these two kind of skeezy guys who are stuck with this young woman and clearly have not seen a woman
sexual
for a while.
Assault usually isn't funny.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I'm not saying it's played for laughs, but I do really appreciate there's the scene where the young woman they've rescued.
Oh, yeah.
Basically just there with a giant rock, like,
I enjoyed
go
her.
Ahead, try it. And I thought, you know,
she was
what?
Great.
That yeah. suggested to me a realization from the people making the movie that, like,
yes.
yeah, those guys are not to be yeah. trust,
no,
like they are
not
idealistic people. They're not people you should be putting your faith in.
Yeah. And it is a little weird because we follow them, so they're kind of our protagonists, more so even than the general, right? Who we see like win a sword fight and spare someone's life and, you know, give, you know, big speeches and things like that. But they're super greedy. They turn on each other, who are theoretically best friends, all the time. They make very poor choices, and then occasionally are super sleazy, skeezy guys.
But I agree with all those things that you're saying. I will say in general, though, like, they never underestimate her. They, as the movie, they allow her to be a ruler in her own right. And that she, in her final speech, is the one who actually convinces the other guy to, like, betray his side and escape with him. And so, like, I actually think other than some, like, occasionally skeezy, like, almost upskirt shots, like, I think as they do a really good job with their character and really enjoyed it.
Everybody's wearing short shorts in this movie.
I know.
Yeah. I was like, is that just the style
of
the time? I don't know. I mean, it's very warm where they are, presumably. I did feel like there's probably a lot of, DNA from this character going into Princess Leia, where she's just, like, she's super competent. She's kind of stuck in this role where, like, she has to survive so her clan can survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
In her political role. There's the thing where, like, she makes them basically buy a sex slave who is a person that's, like, a captive from her former people, right? So that they have a fifth in their group. You know, and she's also shown as pretty... I mean, there's the first scene where she's kind of introduced and the peasants are, like, kind of lecherously chasing her for reasons that are kind of unclear, and she's just knocking them back with a tree branch left and right. So she is not a shrinking violet or anything like that. It's one of those places where I'm curious, is like, was that like a novel thing to have in this kind of movie, or was that, you know, maybe more of a stock character trope to roll out? But she is not she is literally a princess that they're trying to escort to safety. But she's not a damsel in distress. Right?
Yeah.
No.
No. And this is like, Dan and I talk a lot about this, and like, I still think, and I'm sure someone like PhD film student has written about this, of like,
sure.
You think about both sexism and homosexuality and how they're treated in the movies. And bizarrely, in some ways, I think like the 40s and the 50s and 60s are way better about this than the 80s and the 90s. And I couldn't tell you why, but it's super weird. Like, some like it hot, and like some of the very...
Well, there's
like
the whole
Catherine Hepburn is like
pre-code stuff, right?
Yeah.
So there's basically a time when there was simply self-censorship before there would be actual industry censorship.
Yeah, I think maybe it is the McCarthyism that changes it. And I do think like there
thanks, McCarthy.
Yeah, once again. at least it wasn't J.D. Vance this time, guys.
J.D. Vance has returned to this podcast.
But I do think Catherine Hepburn's a great example of, like, I think there were a lot, especially in Westerns. I think sometimes maybe it's something about, I haven't seen any Ford films, but all my Westerns mostly are with experience with, like, again, with Catherine Hepburn and others, like the frontier woman is typically a very strong woman. And I wonder if that comes over, and I don't know if that's typical of Japanese films this time, but maybe Westerns of that time. But I don't know. I'm sure someone has a really interesting paper on it that I should someday read.
Ford, by the way, if you know, also did Stagecoach, My Darling Clementine, Fort Apache, The Searchers, and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance are all John Ford.
I love The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Those are all John Ford
movies. Oh, that's a great movie.
Put that one on the list. not Star Wars related. But yeah, I think there is an element, like you said, of self-reliance, and also the interest in the fact that because they need to hide the princess's identity here, they by necessity are, she's put into a different role than the one she normally occupies. It's not until the very end of the movie that we see her in her like robes and she's all made up and she's like looks kind of like the part. Most of the movie she's running around in these like, you know, in like a blouse and some shorts.
It literally, she's coming back from like a summer camp. Yeah.
And but it speaks to the fact that this dynamic wouldn't even be possible. Like, it would be unthought of to have this dynamic with her in her if this were normal situation. So she's forced to be, you know, in interact with people of this class and to behave in a way maybe that is not necessarily the way she was brought up. It's kind of it's a fish out of water a little bit. But it also, I feel like they mentioned at one point that, don't they mention that her like her dad wanted to raise her as a son, essentially? So there's also that sort of trope.
Do you think the Fire Festival was an inspiration for the Ewok festivals?
Or for the Fire Festival.
Well, that festival was way more successful than the more recent chronological Fire Festival.
Most things are.
I also was thinking,
I'm just saying it actually happened. People had a great
time.
There
was fire.
There was a big fire. Yeah. Apparently they all partied so hard that nobody was around the next day to look to just, you
watch
know,
the guys
stop
digging
people
through the
from
ashes.
Digging through the dirt. I mean, you know, if people are digging through the dirt after a big, you know, blowout party, I'm not going to ask any questions.
I lost my
contacts.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I was thinking also, it made me think, isn't there a whole, there's an Avatar episode where they go to the Fire Nation and there's like a big party or something like
that. I don't remember that.
I vaguely remember this. Anyways. Yeah, and that's a cool scene too. And they reference it later on too, because again, the princess has a moment of being like,
that was really fun.
That was fun. I don't get to do anything that's fun. And it's like, yeah,
I've lived life. I've seen people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about all this princess business.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you mentioned Mifune, who plays our general, Rook Rota. Who has, I think, some, you know, a lot of interesting moments in the film from the very beginning, right, where we learn essentially his sister was the decoy, basically, for the princess and gets executed. And he's like...
Maybe Phantom Menace.
Yeah, I thought about that
there.
With the Padme.
Yeah, that's fair.
But also, you know, again, this is a cultural thing. Like, he is very stone-faced about it.
Yeah.
And the princess gives him a hard time for being like...
Well, and then
don't you feel anything about this?
And, when the woman, I don't think she's ever named, but the one that Tony alluded to, who the sex slave they bought to free her, like she goes to try to then later be the decoy, and he will not let her. He goes out and saves her and pulls her back. And so it's interesting a parallel of those two that he wasn't willing to let someone else die again after the princess chastised him so much for that.
And also a point of the class disparities where people, you know, put so much faith and so much loyalty to the leader of their clans that they will choose to sacrifice themselves.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite have maybe the like Shogun level of DNA of like what is acceptable and not, or at least the text of the movie. I was a little confused when they're Mifune, I'm just referring to him as my actor name now, has his big, not a sword fight technically,
spear fight,
very lengthy. I was not prepared for that to be as long as
20 minutes.
It was. Yeah, I mean, that is a big fight to choreograph and put in the middle of a
movie. It was more exciting than Ahsoka by far.
Yeah. So they have this elaborate spear fight set piece thing and they're surrounded by all these soldiers and he defeats the rival general and spares his life. And there was that kind of like, I didn't know what that meant in the context of this movie, right? Is that a gift? Is that a dishonor? Is that just buying time so he could run away? And I guess I was, in some ways, it's nice that it kind of comes around later. And to a certain extent, the movie is like, it's complicated.
Right.
Yeah.
You
know?
Like, they're also like buddies, sort of, right?
Yeah. They make
the
illusion. Know each other.
They make the illusion at some point, like, we're on opposite sides, but we're friends, right? Like,
yeah.
I was just thinking also there's a little Star Wars influence there too, right? Is the scene where the general rides back on the horse. It's like Han Solo chasing the stormtroopers and then getting to the dead end, right?
Yeah.
He's like, oh, wait. And I absolutely love the way that entire sequence is shot with all the soldiers.
Terrified.
There's one guy, there's 40 guys, and they're so scared of him. And he like walks around, he's like grabbing spears to test them. And they're like, oh, yeah, please take my spear. Yeah, don't hurt me. And it's like, there's like 50 of you.
Yeah.
But they're all, you know, they're not the best.
That's right. He's the legendary, general.
It's great. I because basically the format of this movie is like they have to get from point A to point B, and all these things happen along the way, right?
Yeah.
There's a checkpoint they have to get through. There's a place where they get recognized. There's a place where they're able to like scam their way through. There's a, you know, there's like, speaking of class issues, there's the thing where basically I was unclear who he is, but some upper class guy basically buys their horse out from under
yes,
right? And they're like, well, now we have no horse, we really needed that horse to carry all this gold, but when a rich guy tells you I'm buying your horse, you're not allowed to say no without blowing your cover. You know, you don't have like a handshake that you do where you say like, no, I am also rich and I'm class. I'm just keeping it on the DL. I mean it's interesting because it's kind of just an adventure story. And I think I was expecting a dark, gloomy war story.
Well, to your point there, though, I can, and even if it doesn't tie one to one of like, and I get the Princess Leia, and then like, maybe the gold is the Death Stars. Let me have that one. But I do think the broader thing of what you were saying, Tony, is like, this is just a fun adventure story, right?
Yeah.
And like, that actually does map to A New Hope very well tonally of like, there's some bad guys, but like, it's one thing after another, and they're all like running into hijinks. And that it has that very strong Saturday afternoon matinee at the movies feel to it, which I really think A New Hope more than any of the movies captures.
It is very clear from this, if not like, it's certainly not George Lucas doing a carbon copy of this movie, but you can see it as an ingredient, right, with your Flash Gordon cereals and all that stuff, and how this got contributed to sort of the melange.
And this was probably a movie, not a film historian, but you get the sense that like, this was a time when movies are being made, and their movies are being shared around the world, and along with other media, and things are feeding into each other, right? And George Lucas is picking and choosing what things he wants to make in his sci-fi epic that is going to not look like other science fiction space operas of the time, right? And so he's going to borrow from adventure stories and from a samurai war movie and from things in adventure comic strips and all kinds of things, and put them together into something new that is that is his vision.
Certainly the look too, right? I mean, you think about, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi's costume, think about Darth Vader's helmet. Like, obviously there's a lot of stuff in there that's inspired by samurai movies and the look and feel.
That's fair.
So that's clearly a part. I mean, even certainly the fencing style of the duel between Vader and Kenobi is more classical, you know, fencing than like kendo, but there's a kendo influence to it. So, and certainly even the Jedi as a sort of samurai style class, right? Like that certainly played a part in it. So you can, again, you can see the parts that he's sort of cribbing, but it's homage and it's remixing, right?
Yeah.
That's the part.
I was perhaps expecting something that was going to follow Star Wars a little bit closer in terms of plot structure or something. I think, you know, even in my head, I'm like, oh, maybe the Hidden Fortress is the Death Star. And it's like, no.
I thought this was,
Set
the Death Star on fire that one time.
I see the influences, but it's not like this is the samurai version of A New Hope.
No, it's good. And then the clip from the Criterion Collection, I think it said that George Lucas was exposed to all these films in college?
Film school, I want to say.
Film school.
Like, John Milius, who's also a famous filmmaker, introduced him to Kurosawa.
And like, he just goes see Kurosawa films, movies at like the local movie theater. And that was, I think, a very key time to be influenced in his life. I enjoyed this. This was fun. I would not have picked this up otherwise. And I'm really glad we watched it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I'm glad you've started watching the Light and Magic too.
I
talked about that a little bit before. I think for folks who haven't checked that out yet, Light and Magic is this basically kind of the history of ILM, and there's two seasons of it now. But when I say seasons, I think it's like 9 episodes total.
Yeah, it's pretty short.
It's real short. I just enjoy it. I mean, you know, everything that is made about a company is filtered through some kind of lens of something, but it's a little less of a like, and I think maybe I'm just biased since other companies I tend to be more closely connected to are tech companies. It feels like it is not a glorification.
No, there's some very real, yeah.
Like, yeah. It feels a little bit more like, no, this is our history, and there's some real ups and downs, and we almost fell apart this time, and like, not things were real hard.
Yeah, part of the great thing about season two, and I don't remember if this was true in season one, is that the season two is basically directed by Joe Johnston, who was in ILM, who was part of the founding ILM group. And so everybody knows him, and everybody is like, there's a certain degree of familiarity, a certain degree of like, oh, we'll tell you. But it is fascinating to watch. Like, there's one bit in particular in, I think, the first episode of season two where... No, maybe it was the beginning of the second episode where they're talking about the two people he's interviewing have a very different memory of something that happened.
Is this when they do the animation?
Yeah, when they do the animation bake-off, basically, between two methods. And Dennis Muren's sitting there going like, oh, you know, they totally faked that, whatever. And John Knoll's like, I don't think so. Like, that's not what I remember. And it's like, okay, there's some tension here, you know?
Yeah.
It does. I mean, I appreciate, and, you know, George Lucas is not involved in the business anymore, but this is not a George Lucas
hagiography.
It's you know,
they have a lot of respect for him, and like, he inspired many of them,
but he is a person in that story. He is not like a god.
They're just not like an Elon Musk biography.
There's stories about him that make him sound kind of goofy,
but there's things that he says. There's like, I have a turning point. I was like, of like, he must have been in like horrible to work for in some way.
He does Doug not Chang sound great to work. Doug Chang goes to interview for the design job, and he's just like, George just started telling me everything he wanted in the movie, and I did not have any paper, and I just grabbed napkins and started writing things, and they cut to a shot of him after that meeting, and he looks like he has just been hit by a bus.
But
Doug Chang is like, I don't know what I've done here.
I just, you know, I feel like you see all these things about tech companies, and they're like, we have taken our convoluted story and boiled it down into this, like, you know, oh, we always knew what we were doing, and we were all gods and geniuses. And it's like, guys, you're a bunch of people. Well, there are ups and downs. Like, you can have a bunch of really bright people, but also you gotta get lucky a couple times too, right?
Well, I think that's a couple things. That, like, one, I especially when we got to the how they made Twister and like all the particles, and when I was in college, one of my good friends actually spent a summer doing. He was getting his master's, I think, in computer science and math. And like, he spent a summer with Google, I think, just trying to animate water. And I don't think I appreciated the time of just like, and seeing everyone here in the interviews of just like, A, these people are all incredibly bright and all incredible like mathematicians and scientists in their own right. And like, what it means to then turn that into animation. I was like, wow.
I found it interesting also in terms of, there are some movies that they cover that ILM worked on that I haven't seen, or at least I didn't know were like significant from a history of the technology.
Casper,
War of the Worlds,
Perfect Storm,
Casper, and Perfect. I don't think I've seen. I haven't seen Perfect Storm. They talk about that at length in terms of the water effects of it, and War of the Worlds was a big deal in terms of the digital stuff they did. I think I've seen War of the Worlds, but to me it's pretty forgettable, but which is, you know, a movie can be forgettable but still a big deal for the technology that they
Casper
did
was a great movie. That was a key movie of like fifth grade for me.
You wouldn't be who you are without Casper.
Just thinking about
it. Don't know, it was, we used to watch people's birthday parties.
Is one of the three villains ghosts.
I'd say my favorite unexpected, I don't think I could call it a cameo, but is Masioka showing up to talk about...
He's funny, too.
I forgot that he was a digital artist before he was an actor, but I did know that at some point, and I love it because he is charming as hell, guy needs to be in more stuff.
Just loved him. Like,
why
it's
is not he
funny.
Not in more stuff?
I don't know.
He could be, I don't know. I know it's not funny to like repeat jokes that people just watch them, but I just love the opening scene they show with him is like introducing him to Stan Lee and going, oh, Stan Lee, is that Chinese? Just like, he's a funny guy.
Anyways, highly recommended, especially as there's very little Star Wars content. I will say, I think we have a couple letters that we could answer really quick.
We have to talk about what we're doing next.
I don't know what we're doing next.
Yeah, is that a trap? Sometimes when you do that, Kat, it sounds like a trap.
Or we can do another trivia contest.
Okay, now it's definitely a trap.
You're implying that first one really worked.
Wait a minute. Trivia contest? You mean when we yelled trivia cards at Dan? Didn't we go through all of them?
No, I was thinking about the Dunkin' Donuts trivia thing, which we did.
Oh, okay, that contest.
Psh.
All right. As a reminder, if you'd like to email us, we are acp@theincomparable.com. We can also be found on Mastodon at acp@zeppelin.flights and on bluesky@acp.theincomparable.com. Brian writes in a new bit, Therapist on Tatooine. Sigrona nerds, in listening to episode 104, I was reminded by Tony's comment about not being a professional therapist about a robot chicken Star Wars bit where the Emperor is acting as the therapist to Vader. This could be a false memory. Some Googling could not locate the clip. Since you are not real therapists, but the Star Wars universe needs them, I thought a good bit to do at the end of an episode could be to draw from a name a random character in the Star Wars canon to provide advice for another randomly drawn issue. Random.org may need to be used.
All right, Dan, for our first bit, you will be Ono Watto providing therapy to... Also, Dan, all of the names of this hat are Watto. I apologize.
Hey.
Real careful there, Dan. That's all I'm saying. You want to stop with Watto
That reminds me, just to steal blatantly, one of the podcasts I listen to in the world of Brandon Sanderson that I very much enjoy, like once a year, basically does a number generator and has teams of like, they just pick two random characters from the entire Brandon Sanderson universe and you have to ship them.
And I was like, I feel like this is one of those places where I'm disappointed to be correct. Once again.
It's just fun for the like you're just making absurd arguments about characters. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Okay.
Therapy.
We could do shipper fight for or secret therapist for secret Star therapist. Wars characters.
Corey writes, have to agree with the subject meeting rooms. Have to agree with Tony that meeting rooms generally evoke despair.
I love when people agree with me.
Yeah. Generally evoke despair, but I did have a job where all the meeting rooms were named after sci-fi characters such as HAL 9000 and Jarvis, which was mildly fun. When the company office was finally shuttered, thanks private equity, I was lucky lucky enough to snag one of the room placards.
Oh, fun.
And now my home office is proudly named Jabba, photo attached.
Oh,
he
excellent.
Did send
wow.
us a picture of the placard
that
says Jabba. This bounty hunter is my kind of scum, fearless and inventive, Jabba the Hutt.
I like
it's quoted like it's an inspirational quote.
Oh, it's great.
Naming conference rooms after people is an interesting choice. I'm very used to them being named after places.
Yeah, places.
But also, I have not been anywhere that had named conference rooms in a long, long time. So... I will say at one point, this is not confidential information. This is too boring to be privileged information. At one point, there was a place I was working for as part of the University of Massachusetts systems. One of their central offices had a building where all the conference rooms were named after counties in Massachusetts. And that just felt like the most boring, bland
you tried something.
Choice.
You've just done zip codes. Like,
I mean, it was like, yeah, you know, like, guys, that is exactly one step up from just numbers.
My
counties of Massachusetts. Ugh.
Similarly on brand at HBS, all of the dorms are named after former secretaries of the treasury.
Yeah.
Which is like not after donors, secretaries of the treasury.
Of course. All right, I'm going to look at my Mastodon thing. I think this is where I left off. It's hard to tell because it's been a while since we did this. Paul writes in, Ray episode backstory of a hat. Subject, rabbit hole email number 137. After I was done guffawing at your latest episode, don't change a thing. I was stuck that no one mentioned Lee Marvin, who we did talk about, being in cat favorite Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance,
wow,
in which he played Valance. I was going
to
say title role.
Did the listener listen to this show that we're currently recording?
Yeah, I was like, I'm pretty sure I mentioned that movie. I saw that movie probably 25 years ago, and I just remember loving it.
Yeah. In which he played said Valance, parentheses, I was going to say title role, but that would be the man who shot him, right?
Yeah.
If you do a podcast series on Westerns and or old movies that seem fine when I was a kid, you might consider the Marvin movie that fits both and won him a frickin' Oscar, Cat Ballou from 1965 with Jane Fonda and Nat King Cole. Probably it's sexist and full of bad camp, but I did enjoy it back then. I love the ballad. Thanks for another great show. Please continue. Thank you, Paul. We will put that in the hopper. Michael writes in to say, hi, I'm, quote, that one guy, unquote, that Dan met at WWDC.
Hey!
Hey!
My name is Michael.
Hi, like, Michael.
Like many ACP listeners, apparently.
Story checks out. Our identity verification system, it is simple, but, you know, it works.
Sorry I wasn't able to say hi to Jason Snell, also since I work for MLB and I know he's a big baseball fan and user of our apps, but talking to the Star Wars podcast, Hope, was obviously my first priority.
Way more important.
Keep up the great work. Love the show.
Michael, we like you, but even if we don't always respect your choices, Dan is glad to have met you.
I was delighted that the only person who came up to me randomly at WWDC was a fan of this show.
I will just tell you, I wore a Bunky Dunko shirt to a family gathering in a Midwestern state, and I got a lot of questions, and I'm going to be real careful about where I wear that shirt outside into my house.
You're asking a lot of questions answered by my Bunky Dunko shirt.
They are not. That is the problem, is that shirt only solicits questions. It does not answer them.
Did anyone ask you if it's like a band or something? Yeah, that's what I always assume people think.
No, people are like, what does that have to do with Dunkin' Donuts? Or they get the visual recognition of the imagery.
We did let our child watch the Bunky Dunko music video on YouTube.
He loved it.
He did love it.
And then he was very sad that we're not music videos for all the other songs he listens to.
Oh, he's just like, where's the music video for all songs?
Why is there not a music video for the live version of Frozen, of Let It Go?
I mean, isn't there? Probably?
I think it's just Idina Menzel singing.
Seems kind of, yeah.
Got it.
Steve writes, apologies if someone already sent this in, but I'm just catching up with Andor now. In episode 101, Cat bemoans Disney's lack of some app-based go-back subtitle feature. And I just can't believe you're relying on the streamers to have good apps. Your Apple TV will do this for you. In fact, it's one of the only things Siri does reliably, and I use it all the time. Just press the Siri button in your remote and ask, what did she say? Done. Works with he and they also. I was aware of this, but it's annoying to do. All the number of times, you have to understand the number of times Cat runs the thing back. It would be so annoying.
Again, like our son, what'd you say?
Thank you.
What'd you say?
But thank you, Steve. We appreciate the tip.
What'd you say?
Please stop. Andrew writes in, whenever you say, quote, so-and-so is from the EU, unquote, it takes me a minute to realize, oh, you're not talking about the European Union.
Our podcast is terrible. When he said that, I was like, "Why is this? Why did we get a letter about the European Union?" I confused myself through words I said in the past that were then relayed to us in a letter.
I was with you, Tony. I was also like, "What's wrong?" Like, our listeners are from the EU. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know how it goes. Yep.
They're no longer canon either.
Nope.
Thomas writes, finally listening to this episode, suggestion for a new TV spinoff, Star Destroyer, Lower Decks.
I think the problem is fascism.
You get a bunch of people who like really don't want to be there, but there could be an interesting angle to like them trying to sabotage. Like I think about Biggs Darklighter, right? Like who gets like he's like, I went to the Imperial Academy and then I got assigned to a ship, but I'm gonna go and join the rebels. And it's like, well, what if you had a bunch of people who are like, yeah, we don't really agree with the Imperial thing, and they want to like subtly sabotage everything that the ship is doing.
Guys, you just have to be a little creative.
Okay, I'm just it's tricky. The Lower Decks formula, I think, is built so heavily on the ideals of Star Trek, which is that people are good at their jobs and
that's true. I wouldn't want like the Boimler who's getting really excited about the Empire. Like that would not be a good show.
I mean, I don't even think I'd like if they remade Lower Decks with Boimler with like a British accent. That'd be uncomfortable with that. So, that's just a little too. And his uniform's gray. I'm already uncomfortable. And we haven't even brought it into the Star Wars.
I would settle for Lower Decks like it. I want to spend more time on Yavin 4, and I would settle for the Lower Decks of Yavin 4.
Okay, see, there we go. So it's not Lower Decks Star Destroyer. It's Lower Decks Yavin 4.
So the guy's doing like droid maintenance. And...
Oh, yeah. One of them is a droid, right? You have four characters on Lower Decks. You have a mechanic, you have a droid, maybe a cook. I don't know.
Well, it'd be the Jedi.
That one force healer. Yeah.
The force healer, yeah.
That one force healer.
But she's also a cook. She's a cook and a force healer.
I know we only spend a little bit of time with that character in Andor, but I just feel like, you know, that lady living on Yavin, she's licking a lot of frogs. Can we agree on that?
She's like 97%
frog. Amount of frogs.
Does someone like a frog at some point?
No, it's just a you know what happens when you start licking frogs.
You shouldn't like frogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a
That's
thing.
Why something you think you can heal people with the force.
I guess one of them should probably be an alien. They can't all be human. You got a droid, an alien and two humans. That's how you do it.
Yes, that's right. Eugene Allen.
And it should be a speaking alien.
Star Wars Resistance show, unfortunately.
Oh, damn it.
Oh, man. But they're all aspiring to be pilots.
Star Wars Resistance. Oh, they all want to be pilots.
Now I understand. The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Move it to Tatooine. Oh, no. They all want to be pod racers. No.
All right. Star Destroyer is not looking so bad now for Lower Decks, eh?
What if it's in the New Republic, one of those ones where they repurpose one of the Star Destroyers? For the New Republic.
That could be good. And weirdly, Cad Bane is there.
Just his hat.
It's like Indiana Jones and the hat just sort of blows onto screen.
It's got a mind of its own, that hat. Finally, Michael, a different Michael, writes,
Michael.
Hello. Seeking financial advice, would you recommend taking out a loan with a credit union to pay off credit card debt? Thanks. This, I assume, is a reference to something we talked about financially in an episode, and I literally have no memory of it.
So can you repeat that again, please?
It said, looking for financial advice, would you recommend taking out a loan with a credit union to pay off credit card debt? He wrote debit, but I think he means debt.
I mean, if it's a lower rate, maybe. But we are not financial advisors. Please do not ask us for any financial advice.
I think this comes into something we were talking about.
A complicated profession is not qualified to give financial advice or emotional advice or therapy advice. We are not professionals in any way. I can see how I'm now regretting putting the word profession in the name of our podcast.
Well, it's a complicated profession.
Yeah. I think that is
all
the mail
Dan.
I have.
Good job. Good, Dan. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody who sends mail in. We love, actually, I think mailbag is one of the most fun parts of this show.
Yeah,
it's
no.
Because it constantly amazes me that people listen.
Yeah, no. Listeners, I don't think you understand, we make a bunch of different podcast things. There's a large amount of podcasting that is just throwing bottles into the ocean and I guess dying on a desert island? Is that how this metaphor ends?
Wait, what are you talking about?
That, you're like the messages in a bottle.
Yeah.
Oh, and you hope that someone finds your message in the bottle. Yeah. You're the one on the island. What are overlords on the island?
To Kat, now you know how I feel when someone is spinning a vertical wheel of fortune.
Podcasting is a complicated metaphor, is what we're saying.
Thank you for listening. Extra thank you for writing in, just so that we know that people are listening out there on the weird wild.
Well, on the island, whatever island you're on, just keep sending those bottles.
All right, I regret my bad metaphor, Kat. Is that what you need to hear?
Spin the wheel, find a different one. Can I make a suggestion for what we do next?
I see no way of stopping you.
Well, you can be polite.
Sorry,
I also have a mute button, but I'm not going to do that.
So she's speaking that. Dan recently got a text from, I think, one of your Biff or Rebound co-hosts. Who said they had started listening at the end, the season finale of series two.
Oh, it was Guy. Guy English. Yes,
he's
Guy
like,
English texted
me. We try not to talk about Guy English on this podcast.
He's like, Kat was so nice to you at that point.
That was the episodes when Kat was on that. It was just me and Kat.
And I was at the second podcast I had ever done.
So wait, is the problem that I'm here? Am I like...
Oh, no, it's
I
the dynamic. It's the three person. It's the like...
Okay. And I'm no longer a guest star. So I don't have to be like nice. It's like...
Yeah, no, you're in.
I'm in. I mean, if it's anyone, like marriage. It's great.
Yeah, no, the only person... The person most at Jeopardy being kicked out of this is Dan. We all agree on that,
right?
Yeah,
he was on Jeopardy. Yeah.
That's how Jeopardy works.
The gloves really came off is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Anyways, what I was going to propose before you guys were all very nasty to me.
You're going to need to be more specific.
Continue our Kurosawa kick and watch three things.
One movie. Now you want us to watch three
one
things?
Movie and two episodes. So the movie would be to watch Seven Samurai and then to watch the two Star Wars episodes. I think we decided it was one from Clone Wars, one from The Mandalorian that are just The Seven Samurai.
It's the bounty hunters episode of Clone Wars, when you can tell they were really imaginative with names of episodes. And I don't remember the name of the Mandalorian episode.
Can I add that
it's the one with Cara Dune in it?
In addition to that, we should watch clearly the Three Amigos, which is also a Seven Samurai.
Is it really?
It kind of is.
I've never seen the Three Amigos.
I don't want to watch the Three Amigos.
No, you don't.
I don't think it. I've seen clips from it.
It
has not aged well.
No. It is at least partially a pastiche on Magnificent Seven Samurai, I believe.
Well, anything, we'd watch the not the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's the
isn't there
the Magnificent Seven? There we go.
Yes. The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, Dan, I
literally said that as we were trying to think about it.
Isn't there a version of the Three Amigos that Disney did where it's like Donald Duck and two other guys? That,
yes.
There is a version.
I would watch
of that.
That's probably less racist.
Yeah. I'm just, you know, I just really don't care for Chevy Chase.
Yeah,
so.
Chevy Chase is not aged well.
Yeah.
Well, no,
in every sense of the word.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing I was thinking of is the Three Caballeros.
Caballeros.
I'm uncertain how much this has anything to do with the Three Amigos, other than having the word three in the title
and vaguely being Mexican or Spanish, the Spanish words that have a sort of Mexican influence on it. Upon, yeah, I will say it is very funny to me that both the Clone Wars episode that we're talking about and the Mandalorian episode, I think, are about half an hour, and the Seven Samurai is much longer than that. It's at least 2.5 hours. It may be 3 hours. It's a long movie.
Yeah. Akira Kurosawa movies take their time.
Anyways, we will. I guess we can consider
we'll
doing that.
We don't have time pressure. Like, we've got years till the next Star Wars show. So
yes, I do only have 2 days left in that Criterion 7-day trial. So here we gotta get moving on that. Is what I'm saying.
Here, I'll do the trial next with my phone.
Oh, there you go.
There we go.
All right.
And write in with suggestions if there's something that you think we should watch.
Yeah, we've already got the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance on the list there.
So
we're
going
to take a hard pivot into Westerns and Samurai movies. It's a bold
choice.
There
are worse podcast pivots than I've seen made.
Also, does anyone else on the comparable do Westerns?
Maybe Lion Tower and Shield, maybe.
I don't know. They do classic old movies.
Yeah, they do classic movies.
Like, and again, Star Wars is fundamentally a spaghetti Western, so like, let's do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
Cat, in The Good and the Bad and Ugly, which one is which?
I've never seen that one. I've only ever seen The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, which is the Korean one, which is actually really good.
Okay.
I really like it. It's The Good, the Bad, and the
We're
Weird.
We're going
it's
very
phenomenal.
Far afield.
Mm-hmm. I love that movie. I would watch that movie again.
All right. We have reached the end of this episode,
and then
I
there's
believe.
Both True Grit, but I do like the original True Grit better.
I like when Dan tries to end an episode and we don't help him.
No, do not help me.
Tony, we're having a conversation here.
There is a frequent time where I say goodbye to one of you, and then you go off on a soliloquy that lasts another 5 minutes, and we're like, we're in the goodbyes.
It's a soliloquy or a monologue?
Yeah, which one is it?
I guess it's a monologue because the rest of us are on stage.
Yeah, yeah,
Dan,
hello.
We're very theatrical. That's part of what our charm is.
Oh, I know.
Do you want to wrap it up now?
Thank you, everybody out there, for listening.
Any second now, Dan.
Especially to our members for supporting the show, but who go to theincomparable.com/members, where they sign up and they get lots of great perks, like being in our members' Discord and getting bootleg episodes and exclusive member content and swag. It's great. You should do it. We really appreciate it because it helps support the show. You know, the show has no ads. We just do it for fun, but it's nice to have a little financial compensation for it.
Jen, what would you even do with that money? Buy food or things for your child? I don't even understand.
All
what
I'm saying
mean?
Is I like not have to everything. Have to drag a giant cart full of firewood hundreds of miles just to get some gold.
Okay.
But most of all, I would like to thank my co-hosts. Kat Benish, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. And I definitely now have a message in a bottle by the Police stuck in my head.
Mm.
Message in a bottle.
You can't. That's about as much as you can offer that. It's getting sued. So.
Yeah, that's right. There's legal issues there. Tony Sindelar, always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everybody out there, for listening. We'll be back. But until then, may the Force be with you.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.